I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. The images of oil-coated animals on the beach after the Exxon Valdez oil spill rallied environmentalists, but the company has made quite the recovery since then. This hour, we'll talk about the power ExxonMobil now wields in the American corporate world and the secrecy that surrounds this energy empire. Later, KCUR's Greg Eklund joins us to talk about the Royals' rocketing start and steep decline this season, and what it means that George Brett is now the interim hitting coach. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Today, our topic is huge. Today, our topic is ExxonMobil. Try this on for size. Last year, the company earned a $44.9 billion profit that was just $300 million short of the world record. The retirement package of its former chief executive, Lee Raymond, that would be $398 million. If revenue were counted as gross domestic product, the corporation would rank among the top 30 countries. ExxonMobil runs one of Washington's biggest lobbying operations, and it even has its own army. Today, a conversation about this country's largest and most powerful private corporation that operates more than 1,800 gas and oil leases in Kansas. Later on this hour, a look at another public corporation, not nearly as successful, the Kansas City Royals. We'll take a look at what in the world has been going on with our team. But first up, ExxonMobil. Joining us is Steve Call, who took a very close look at this corporation last year in his book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. Steve is also the author of Ghost Wars, a Pulitzer-winning account of the CIA's arrogant bungling in pre-2001 Afghanistan. Steve, welcome. So nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
Well, this is a very dark look at this enormous corporation. You know, some employees call it its ominous headquarters near Dallas, the Death Star. The corporation is known for its secrecy, non-disclosure agreements, and internal security. No comment is typically how it responds to the media. Is there anything bright and positive about this corporation?
Oh, I think, you know, like any place, if you are inside the walls, it's probably not a bad place to work at all. It's a very one of the few cradle-to-grave employers in this country anymore because our oil economy is so stable and so durable that it's one of the places you can start to work at age 20 and retire in very comfortable shape at 65. And it's a very successful corporation at what it does. It's run by engineers. It emphasizes discipline, safety, operating, and financial performance. It's a very rule-bound corporation, so I think a lot of us journalist types might chafe at the number of procedures that would be involved in employment there. But if you can adapt to the rules, you can have a job for life.
Just how big is it?
Well, that's what interested me most. I think, like a lot of reporters, you know, I'm interested in concentrated power, and most of the time we focus our interest on government power appropriately, but. You know, here's this behemoth sitting at a headquarters down in Irving, Texas. As you said, $44 billion in profits last year, $450 billion in revenue, with operations spread out all over the world affecting all kinds of different societies in Africa, in the Middle East, in Europe, all over the United States. And it receives virtually no scrutiny. I mean, virtually no scrutiny. Now, they're very good at deflecting scrutiny. But they also are just not understood. They're not examined. Tough questions aren't asked about the decisions they make. And so my purpose really was not to prosecute them or to run a crusade, but just to try to get inside the wall. Because I think in the United States, we have a history of wondering about what the dangers of concentrated private power really are. And here's a case where we don't even really know what the organization is, what principles it runs on, how it wields its influence.
You know, how much access did you get and how much response to the book did you receive?
Well, they the book notes reflect that they made available eventually after 4 years of conversation, you know, six or seven of their executives for background interviews. I didn't regard that as a lot of access. I think, in fairness to them, they probably regarded it as a lot more than they normally do.
Yeah, sure.
But mostly I did this from the outside in, using court records, traveling all over the world. I did about 400 interviews, including with former executives and former employees. I talked to competitors. I talked to leaders in the countries where they do business, and all the things you do as a reporter, using a lot of public records as well, Securities and Exchange Commission filings and the like. And out of that, you know, you can start to, if you take enough time, you can start to put a real portrait together. But I tell you, it's hard work. My last three books,
I can imagine.
CIA, the Bin Ladens, ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil was by far the hardest of the three, harder to report on than the CIA.
How did they react to the book? What kind of feedback did you get from ExxonMobil?
No official communication to me from ExxonMobil. They didn't sue me, which was good so far, you know, knock on Formica.
Yeah.
But, you know, they studied silence as kind of their response to most of the world's journalists and politicians. They're a very difficult group to read. I think I set out to write a book that an ExxonMobil executive would read and say, well, that was tough but fair. And I recognize our company in this. It's not a made up cartoon. Mm-hmm. So I tried to get it right, and I tried to understand the world from their perspective. That's always of interest. You know, I think, irregardless of what moral or political judgment you make about an institution like ExxonMobil, you say, well, what is their theory of the case? How do they see the world? What are the problems that keep them up at night? How do they make their decisions? Who are they trying to influence? What are they trying to achieve in Washington, D.C.? Why do they spend money on lobbying? Who are their lobbyists? What are they asking for? Those kinds of questions. And those are kind of neutral questions, just hard to get the answers to.
We're talking with Steve Call about his book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. So what was the takeaway for you after 4 years, 5 years of researching this huge corporation? Did you walk away with more respect? Did you walk away thinking more critically about them? Where were you? Or all of the above?
You know, I didn't know what to think when I began. I tried to keep an open mind. I assumed that the kind of cliches that they're evil incarnate, or that they're, you know, the answer to our energy problems, that none of those sorts of extreme arguments could possibly be right. But I wasn't quite sure what the alternative was. And what I came away with was certainly great respect for the discipline that they're able to maintain in their operations. If having worked in large organizations, I know how hard it is to manage a large, diverse workforce and achieve your goals year after year. They do that very well. They're a very well-managed financial and engineering company. And if you had a relative who worked on an offshore oil platform, you'd rather they work at ExxonMobil because they're more likely to come home in one piece every night. You know, having said that, what really their significance beyond that is, they really are like a state within our state. They're like a government unto themselves. They really, interestingly, yes, they collude with sympathetic politicians. And yes, the chief executive of ExxonMobil had an intimate friendship with Vice President Cheney, mm-hmm. which he sometimes called on to get oil deals done around the world. So the sort of Hollywood version of how they operate in world politics is partially true. At the same time, they told the Bush administration no again and again because they didn't see themselves as subordinate to the United States. They saw themselves as a empire unto their own. They had interests spread out all over the world. They couldn't afford to be too closely identified with the United States government. For example, they didn't want to bear the burden of U.S. human rights policy around the world because they wanted to do business with dictators and to be able to say, hey, the State Department may be badgering you about your prisons, but we're not. We're here to do business with you.
And they didn't want to help out after the second Gulf War either. The administration came to them and said, we need help reestablishing Iraq's oil infrastructure. And ExxonMobil said, no way.
Exactly right. And why? You know, you'd start to ask, well, so how do they see the world? They have their own foreign policy. They have their own defense policy, in effect, because they've got interests spread out all over the world. And so from their perspective, their business model is they drill holes in the ground and then they sit on top of those holes for up to 40 years. They want a world that is stable. They want a world that is friendly to drilling holes for oil. And they want a world that is friendly to the rule of law and contracts because they're a business. They want clarity and stability in the contracts that they undertake. So the invasion of Iraq to them was misbegotten. That's not the kind of response that's likely to generate stability.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were deeply ambivalent, if not privately opposed to the invasion. And they sat out the war. As you say, the Bush administration said, look, hey, we've done you a few favors. Now we need you to show the American flag in Baghdad and show the world that Iraq is coming together. This is in 2004 when Iraq was coming apart.
Mm-hmm.
And ExxonMobil looked at it independently and they said, A, it's not safe for our people, and B, we're not here to carry your flag. We'll go into Iraq when we think it's in our interest to do so.
To what extent, Steve, does ExxonMobil set the price of a gallon of gas in this country?
Not to any real great extent. The price of a gallon of gas in this country is set by world oil prices, which are themselves, as an economist would say, liquid. In other words, they're in effect, there is one price for world oil. There are differentiations depending on transportation costs, the quality of a particular barrel of oil, but essentially it's all an integrated price. And the price rises and falls on the basis of global supply and demand. And global supply and demand is affected by events way outside the United States, to the frustration of American drivers who pull up to the pump and see gas 30 cents higher than it was the month before. And an economist would say, well, that's because there was a war in Nigeria. Well, mm-hmm. Okay, if you're filling up a pickup truck, you know, in Kansas, that doesn't really compute. And the oil companies are one of the few marketers of a consumer product as important to the lives of ordinary Americans as gasoline is, who put their name right on the price that makes people so angry. So you're standing there filling up your truck, you say, what? Why is this 30 cents more than it was a month ago? Well, you know, somebody says it has something to do with Nigeria, but I know it's these oil companies. And look, their name's right on the pump. They must be making 30 cents more profit than they were the week before.
Yeah.
That's not actually how it works. But the truth is that these companies are huge, they're powerful, and Americans naturally blame them for this volatile price.
And why shouldn't Americans do that, Steve, given the fact that, as I said at the top of the show, ExxonMobil last year earned $44.9 billion. We're all paying more for that gallon of gas. How is that right? How is that fair?
Well, you know, it goes to the basic history of energy in this country. You know, think about electricity. You turn on a switch in the studio and generate a little bit more light than was there before. Who profits from that? A utility company. Now, that utility company, under the history of our country, is regulated under a public interest standard. Mm-hmm. They're only allowed to make certain amounts of profits. Their investments are reviewed by regulators accountable
That's
to the public.
Right.
And those decisions are made on the basis, at least in part, varies from place to place, on a public interest basis. Now, gasoline is really a utility. It's like electricity. Americans can't live without it. If you're a small contractor with a truck full of tools, you got to drive 50 miles to a job site, you got no choice. You got to fill up your tank. But the regulation of how that gasoline is produced, refined, and priced is not undertaken for historical reasons, accidental reasons, the way a utility would be regulated. So there's no public interest standard. So in that sense, I think you're right. Americans are right to be angry. Their voices are not heard. There is no line of communication between the consumer of gasoline and the decision makers at the oil companies the way there is in other important areas of our sort of energy economy, especially electricity.
And yet you hear politicians all the time saying, like Claire McCaskill in Missouri, saying it's time to stop giving all those subsidies to big oil. And how could she possibly be wrong, given the fact ExxonMobil made $44.9 billion dollars?
Right. Well, subsidies, you know, one person's subsidy is another person's kind of, you know, tax depreciation allowance. And there's a lot of politics tied up with bashing oil companies. Not that, as we say, there isn't a basis for the anger, but when you hear politicians call out ExxonMobil by name, just be clear about one thing. The reason they're doing it is because focus groups and polling have shown again and again that ExxonMobil is the most unpopular corporation in the country.
Yeah. How do they feel about that?
It was a question I was very interested in. So what's it like to be hated?
Yeah.
What's your strategy for being hated? And, you know, it does create a little bit of a bunker mentality. And part of the reason they're so secretive and they're so tough and incommunicative is they haven't quite figured out an answer about how to deal with being hated other than to close down the hatches and say, oh, it's us against them. And we're just here to do our business. And, you know, the rest of them will figure it out on their own time. But they have done a lot of research trying to change the equation. And what they've discovered is, and it goes to our earlier conversation, their popularity in private polls that they run goes up and down with gas prices. That's it. It's totally linked to gas prices. And they know it's sort of irrational, but they can't do anything about it. So when gas prices are down, their poll numbers go up. When gas prices are up, they know that they're in trouble. Now, in the 2008 campaign, gas prices were spiking for a variety of reasons that had to do with things offshore around the world. And you had both Barack Obama calling ExxonMobil out during debates, almost gratuitously, just dropping their name into any line, ExxonMobil, 40 billion. Mm-hmm. And Sarah Palin was doing the same thing. And I remember one ExxonMobil executive said to me, well, when we heard Sarah Palin and Barack Obama call us out during debates, we knew that we were going to lose the election. That was basically the way it goes down in Irving.
Steve Kalla speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. That's the Central Branch downtown at 14 West 10th Street. To RSVP, to grab a seat, go to kclibrary.org to meet Steve Kalla. He writes big, important books, and he does it while he does jobs like serving as managing editor of the Washington Post. How you manage that, I will never understand. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. You can also tweet us at kcuruptodate. Steve, this book begins with a very hard look at the Exxon Valdez accident in 1989 up in Alaska that, as so many of us remember, resulted in tens of thousands of gallons of crude splashing up on shores up there and destroying all manner of wildlife. Walk us through that night in 1989 and what happened there.
So the Valdez was docked at the port of Valdez, which is at the end of the Trans-Alaska pipeline that pumps mm-hmm. North Slope oil to world markets through the tankers that grab it there and go out to sea. And Captain Joseph Hazelwood was the captain of the Valdez that night. And he boarded the ship around 9 p.m. after drinking at a bar locally. Had a few.
He'd had a history of that.
He had a history of he'd had a DUI arrest, and he was a very talented man. He made about $100,000 a year as a tanker captain, but he put that salary in jeopardy by drinking to excess. He described later on the witness stand his own patterns of drinking, which involved, you know, sort of four or five doubles before dinner, and then wine, and then more doubles afterward. And he said, you know, I never became impaired. But obviously he had become so involved with alcohol, addicted to alcohol, that he didn't really quite have control of his relationship with it. And so he was both functional and clearly impaired at the same time. He goes up on the bridge. They go out into the sea, heading towards open markets where they're going to deliver this oil. And essentially that Prince William Sound, I'd never been there until I did the research for this book. Everybody should go up and see it once. It's a beautiful part of America that most people don't see, an inland sea teeming with wildlife, sea lions, seals, yes. bald eagles, salmon schools, halibut schools. But it's trafficked by these oil tankers going back and forth. You couldn't imagine more of a wildlife refuge as a kind of superhighway for oil tankers. And essentially, the Valdez goes out to sea, and the way the traffic was organized was you go outbound, drive in the right-hand lane. Inbound comes on the left-hand lane. He's going out in the dark. He sees an iceberg floating in the water. That was not uncommon. The Columbia Glacier delivers these icebergs in the spring. And there was a standard procedure, which is you call back to the Coast Guard, say, there's an iceberg in front of me. I'm going to turn left into the inbound lane. If there's no oncoming traffic, go around the iceberg and then tack back to my lane and continue on. Coast Guard says, do that. Hazelwood asks his mate, can you handle this? He goes downstairs, and basically the next thing that you know, they run aground on an uncharted, a very well-charted reef. Essentially, a confusion took hold in the among the pilots.
And Hazelwood had gone downstairs.
He was not even on board.
Yeah.
And he heard this terrible ripping sound. Oil, could smell the oil pouring out of the hull. Someone came down and banged on his door and said, we're a vessel aground, and then I said a word that I won't say on the air. And he ran upstairs and he went into the to the John and threw up and said to himself, I knew the world as I'd known it had come to an end.
That was such a great line. Just one or two sentences in your book, but what a great moment. He comes up, he looks overboard, sees the oil burbling out of, whatever that word is, gurgling out yeah. of the ship's hold, and knows right there and that he's done.
His life is over.
And, yeah.
You know, what's interesting about that whole, you step back and ask about some of the larger meanings of that wreck. Of course, it changed ExxonMobil dramatically, which is part of the theme of the book, but also just the accident itself. You know, it was such an easy target, drunk driving. That's what happened. Oh, it was yeah. drunk driving, and great jokes on late night television.
Yeah.
You know, David Letterman, why did he hit the iceberg? He was trying to get some ice for his margarita, various things like that. But, you know, it's actually, that's not, you look with the benefit of all the investigations that followed, the drunk driving metaphor is too easy. First of all, he wasn't on the bridge. Second of all, there was a whole history of regulatory failure and corporate failure at Exxon that preceded and explained that wreck. The Coast Guard had stripped down its ability to survey ships like that. It couldn't even see what the Valdez was doing when it grounded. Exxon had cut its workforce from 180,000 to 100,000 in the 10 years before the wreck, during the Reagan years. This was the Reagan deregulatory wave, and it affected the Coast Guard, and it affected Exxon as it responded to falling world oil prices, stripped down its safety departments. This was a product of systemic neglect. It was not a drunk driving accident.
Let's go to some phone calls. 816-235-2888, and our email address, again, UpToDate at KCUR.org. Mark from Leawood, good morning.
Good morning. What's the relationship between Citizens United and maintaining the cost of oil because of all these subsidies that the federal government allows? If Citizens United had not been a Supreme Court decision, would that change more easily?
Yeah. He's talking about unbridled, unlimited campaign donations and the impact on ExxonMobil. Yeah.
Right. Well, as we learned in the last campaign, one of the holdings of Citizens United is to remind corporations are people under the First Amendment, and so they have the right to speak, quote unquote, through their donations. But yes, I mean, of course, the members of Congress who decide on the tax code, including the degree of subsidy or allowances for oil companies of ExxonMobil's size, basically, as you know, if you're a creature of Washington, they spend at least half of their days raising money. And they know that Citizens United has changed the landscape for where their funds are going to come from. And that means that corporate money in lots of different ways, both direct giving to candidates, but also these groups that can be supported through undisclosed donations, and we saw so active in the last campaign, are going to shape who wins and loses a race. And that's going to change, you would think, the behavior of those members.
Yeah. Mark, thank you for the call. Maria writes us at UpToDate at KCUR.org. If there's a global price for oil and therefore gasoline, how is it that gas in the States is so much cheaper than in Europe?
Taxes, basically. Europe taxes gasoline deliberately in order to discourage its use in cars. And so, you know, Europe's a much more densely populated place than the United States. They've built a lot of trains and public transport, some of which we could have built and haven't, some of which would be implausible because we're just so spread out and sprawling as a continent. But essentially, the answer is they deliberately keep the price high to discourage people from driving, especially in cities.
Going back to the Valdez accident, what kind of shape is Prince William Sound these days?
When I visited, it seemed in many ways to have recovered, but there's an ongoing dispute between ExxonMobil and the state of Alaska and some groups that were set up under state supervision after the accident about how complete the recovery is. And I was amazed to discover I rented a seaplane and a vessel, and I went out to one of the islands where the oil had originally blown up in 1989 because a storm came through and scattered the oil, made the accident much worse than it would have been. And in some rocks on that island in 2011, I dug down into the soil, and there was fresh oil still there, trapped in certain areas of that sound. Because of the geology, the oil has never congealed. It's not been exposed to the wind and the sun, so it hasn't dried up into tar. It's still just sitting there. And it is toxic. And so there's part of the dispute is whether or not wildlife encounters it indirectly, salmon spawning or other mammals who forage for food in these shoreline areas, whether they are suffering still all these years later through exposure to these documented, they're clearly there. I have a jar of the oil myself on my shelf in my office, occasional exposure to this residue.
That's just amazing to me that it's still there all yeah. these years later.
It's, you know, nature's a funny thing. It's pretty, and oil is a substance that can dry up and go away, can dissolve, but in some circumstances it can endure.
There was some upside to that accident and the fallout from it, double hulls and everything else. Tell us what happened as a result of the Valdez accident.
Well, there were changes in regulation for tankers that make it much less likely that a similar accident would produce a spill of that scale. A lot of the risk management that exposes wildlife and our environment to catastrophic failure is actually not so much associated with tankers anymore. It has to do with deepwater drilling, as we saw in the Deepwater Horizon case, and as you see with Shell struggling in the Arctic. You know, the impact of the Valdez was both regulatory but also internal to ExxonMobil, and a lot of the story in the book is about how the company tried to remake itself, really radically was motivated by a kind of never again philosophy, and so a lot of the rulemaking and the internal discipline that is characteristic yeah. of ExxonMobil today started as a reaction to that accident.
Let's take a break. Steve Call is our guest. His book again, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. When we come back, we'll talk about Lee R. Raymond, a tough guy who was a longtime chief executive of ExxonMobil. Tough guy who liked a glass of milk with popcorn in it. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with veterinarian Wayne Hunhausen about comfort pets, you can find it at kcur.org. From the donations to the tables, we'll hear from the retiring CEO of Harvesters tomorrow about where the food comes from and where it goes, plus a look at Martha Jefferson Randolph, a de facto first lady. But this segment, we're visiting with Steve Call about his new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. If you want to join us here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. Well, Steve, you interviewed Lee Raymond, a tough guy who was the longtime chief executive of ExxonMobil. Tough, mean, worked long hours, and liked a glass of milk with popcorn in it. Tell us about Lee Raymond.
Well, he was rising to power inside the corporation when the Valdez accident happened, and he really used it to kind of turn the company upside down. He then engineered the merger with Mobil some years later and left, retired in 2006, I think regarded as the most successful oil executive of his generation. But as you say, an intimidating figure who was controversial for a number of reasons outside of the oil industry. One was that he had a personal conviction that climate change was a hoax, and he pressed that view by funding groups, often without disclosing that he was doing so, who tried to stir up doubts about emerging climate science. And he also was a very blunt and combative public speaker. He'd go up to Wall Street, and the analysts would ask him questions, and he would shoot them down. Reading the transcripts just, you know, makes you flinch from time to time.
He oftentimes made journalists feel stupid with their questions. How was your own experience with him?
Well, I think he is in retirement now, and he was kind enough to receive me a couple of times, and he spoke at length. And to be honest, you know, I think he probably figured I'd heard a few people talk about him who had been bruised by his leadership, and he wanted to make sure I understood that he was a three-dimensional person, and he did that effectively. I found him you can't run an oil company the size of ExxonMobil without being a pretty smart and sophisticated guy for as long as he did. He is very sophisticated about journalists, as it turns out, and he was a very good interview in the sense that he actually got into the stories and the details and took the questions seriously, and I found it very productive. I was glad I had a chance to
talk to him. And you met him where, down in Texas?
Down in Texas. He's retired in Dallas, yeah.
816-235-2888. Let's go to Shannon from Overland Park. Shannon, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, there was a book that I read by Lester Brown called World on Edge. In that book, he interviewed Øystein Dahl, the former vice president of Norway, Exxon, the Exxon branch in Norway. And Øystein Dahl said that capitalism failed because it didn't tell the economic truth, environmental truth, just as communism failed because it didn't tell the economic truth. Environmental truth. So, what I guess I'm saying is, Exxon has a pretty good understanding of what's going on with capitalism in that it doesn't tell the environmental truth. And I was just wondering, what further comments can you make about what Exxon knows and what their future, like what their goals are?
Right. Thank you, Shannon. Thank you, Shannon. And I should point out, ExxonMobil today at least does acknowledge global warming, right?
They do. Well, they acknowledge that it's dangerous enough to warrant a price on carbon, which is a big shift from policies they'd pursued before, and that's important.
A gasoline tax, in a sense.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about that question for me is that fundamental to ExxonMobil's position today in the United States, but also around the world, is that they manage risk of an enormous scale. You look at something like the Deepwater Horizon, the underlying facts of the oil industry is that there's no easy oil anymore. All of the oil that you can really access involves either environmental risk, like you see in the Gulf of Mexico or in the Arctic, or it involves political risk. It means going into unstable countries in Africa and trying to drink. And, a company like ExxonMobil keeps telling itself, never again. We're not going to ever make a mistake on the scale of the Valdez. We have such discipline and such procedures that Deepwater Horizon could never have happened to us. Their chief executive testified to Congress. And I thought, wow, that sounds like hubris to me. I mean, wringing all human fallibility out of high-risk operations of that type, as you see in commercial aviation, right, in the space program, you can't ever change human nature. So you're going to have these kind of bet the company accidents. So the question isn't, can you get to zero accidents? It's, can you prevent a catastrophe on the scale of Valdez or Deepwater Horizon? And, the problem is the harsher environments that they drill in, the harder it is to contain an accident once it starts.
And that's the risk they're up against every single day out there.
Yeah, it's sort of the basic tension. In a novel, you're always looking for the tension between the protagonist and the dilemma the protagonist faces. In ExxonMobil's case, they are a risk-averse company to the T. They are the most risk-averse company you could find. And yet their business model is driving them towards greater and greater risk. Political risk, because they have to go off to these far-flung, unstable countries engulfed in civil wars, and environmental risk because they have to go into deeper and deeper water, into harsher and harsher climates, north of the Arctic Circle, places where nobody's ever drilled before. And they tell themselves, well, it's not going to happen to us.
The Deepwater Horizon thing, was that on ExxonMobil's watch? It wasn't, was it?
No. That was BP entirely.
BP,
And their contractors. But, ExxonMobil had made certain claims along with BP and the other companies that they could contain and respond to a spill like that. And Deepwater Horizon exposed that those plans were completely under-resourced, really just fantasies.
Well, the guy who now heads the company, his name is Rex Tillerson. He's been there since 2005. Tell us about him. What kind of man is he?
Well, he's born and bred Texan. His father was a Boy Scout of America administrator. He grew up in his high school years in Huntsville, Texas, rose up inside the company. Nobody comes to ExxonMobil from the outside. It's like the U.S. Marine Corps. You don't get to be the top man by having a successful career at IBM. There's hardly any lateral movement into the company at high ranks. It's totally born and bred. And, he was chosen as Lee Raymond's successor in part because he had experience in the global side of the business and dealing with Russia and those sorts of places, but also because they were looking for someone who could maybe take some of the edge off of Lee Raymond's communication style, someone who wouldn't bruise everybody he came into contact with and who could talk about global warming and American politics in a way that wouldn't incite opposition. And he's attempted to do that.
Lisa writes us this on email. What does the author think of the scholarship and accuracy of the book, The End of Oil by Paul Roberts?
I like Paul Roberts. I think it's an interesting survey of alternative energy futures. I think there's a little bit of optimism about some of those sources of alternative energy, and not all of the forecasts of the people he interviews, is not him, but the people mm-hmm. he's talking to, have been borne out. But I think it's a useful book. I learned something from it.
How does ExxonMobil regard fracking, you know, the controversial means of extracting oil from the earth that's being performed in Kansas, uses lots of water deep underground, and it's being used in many other places as well? What about fracking? Because they're using it a lot.
ExxonMobil is probably the largest practitioner of unconventional gas production fracking in the United States today.
Mm-hmm.
That's their biggest bet under Rex Tillerson. Was they bought a company called XTO, and in doing so, they basically bought into the fracking proposition in North America in a big way. And so it's a very interesting dilemma. We were talking about this rigid conservative company facing risk. Now this rigid conservative company that doesn't always communicate very well faces the public controversies over fracking and has to figure out how they're going to persuade communities all across the United States that this is safe. And that requires a kind of adeptness to public life in the United States that I'm not sure that ExxonMobil has demonstrated it possesses. But they've made a big financial bet on fracking.
Well, lots of that going on in rural Kansas where folks aren't a lot of people down there and people don't pay a whole lot of attention to it.
Well, you know, part of the politics of fracking and also, frankly, of offshore drilling is that there's kind of a red state, blue state phenomenon. There are parts of the oil patch in the United States, in Oklahoma and Texas and elsewhere, where people have accommodated themselves to the industry. They know that there are environmental risks, but there are also jobs and growth, and they believe in it. And then there are places like, you know, Pennsylvania and New York where this is new or it hasn't been around in 100 years. One thing about fracking is even if you think it's safe for the water, it does change the landscape. It industrializes the landscape. And lots of parts of rural New York, nobody wants to reindustrialize.
Yeah.
These are, you know, gentlemen farmers on holiday from their banking jobs in Boston and New York. So it's the controversy cuts in lots of different directions.
Well, Steve Call is the author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. Again, he speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. Terrific book. Thanks for your time today, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
So good to have you.